Still to come on the programme, heaps and heaps and heaps. We're going to be talking a little bit later on this hour about sustainable tech when it comes to changes in air travel and seaplanes. Back to the Future might be one of the things that can help to reduce our carbon footprint. Also after 11 o'clock this morning, Deborah Francis-White, the guilty feminist, is going to be in to talk to us ahead of her tour of Aotearoa. And also Leah McFall, with books her friends borrowed and never gave back. And on that subject, people have said, someone in Wellington, this person says, has my signed copy of Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain. And, in all caps, you know who you are. Apparently. Someone else saying, I take a picture of the person holding the book to keep track and send them their picture when time's up. That's from Nick. I think that's a rather nice way to do it. Now, though, if you have a smartwatch or a health tracker, I don't have either of these, but I do have a humble smartphone. And digital twins have become part of our everyday lives, even if that's not a term that you've come across. A digital twin is a virtual model which evolves in parallel alongside real-world data. And this, of course, opens up a world of possibilities of which we're only just scratching the surface. My guest to talk on this is Professor Karen Wilcox from the University of Texas in Austin. She's originally from Auckland. Kia ora, thank you for being with us, Karen.
Kia ora, Susie. It's great to be here with you.
So, a digital twin. What is a digital twin?
Well, you just gave a great definition. A digital twin is a virtual representation. So think a computer model and maybe think about your favorite thing in the real world. Maybe it's an airplane, a spacecraft, a car. Maybe it's you, a human being. And now imagine this computer model that represents that object, represents that aircraft, represents that human. And what's really special about this computer model is that it's not fixed, it's not static, but it's really talking to the physical world. And so as data are being generated, as the airplane is flying or is degrading, or as the human is changing, maybe the human's getting sick, data from the physical world is feeding into the virtual world, updating that digital twin. And then that digital twin can be used to make predictions about the future and to guide decision making.
Mm. So, as you say, it's not static. It does evolve. It is dynamic. I suppose, how far advanced is this?
You know, it's at different levels of advancement in different fields. So this idea of having a computer model that could follow a physical system and change is actually a very old idea. And actually, I was just listening in on the news. Every day we get the weather report. In some sense, there's a digital twin of planet Earth going on there, where a computer model is being fed with data from sensors that are collected, around a region and being updated. So In some fields, and I think weather forecasting is a great example of one, this idea has been around for quite a while. In other fields, the idea is quite new, and we're just at the cusp of starting to be able to create digital twins, with, of course, many, many more challenges open until we could really achieve that vision that we talked about.
Before we get onto that, tell us about where the concept, the idea originated.
So the term digital twin comes from the field of aerospace engineering, and I'm an aerospace engineer. The term itself was first came about around 2010 through some work that NASA was doing with technology road mapping. But this idea is, as I already said, much older. And many people actually point to the Apollo program as being one of the first places where the idea really came to be. And there's a great blog post online that the listeners can read where they talk about, again, the Apollo program, where NASA would launch a physical spacecraft up into space. And at the same time, they would keep a simulator. So this is not a digital simulator. It was actually a physical simulator, but it was a simulator that they would keep on the ground in Houston. And that simulator would follow along with the mission of the spacecraft that went into space. And this became very famous in the Apollo 13 mission, and it became famous thanks to Hollywood, probably, if we've all seen the movie, where in Apollo 13, there was an accident, there was a malfunction, the spacecraft became damaged and became stranded up in space. And so the story goes that NASA was able to take the data from the physical spacecraft, now stuck up in space with the astronauts on board, feed that data into the simulator on the ground in Houston. Now adapt, so update the simulator so now it represented the damaged spacecraft, and then use that simulator to run the scenarios, to play all the what ifs, what if we did this, what if we did this, to ultimately inform the decisions that brought the astronauts back home safely. And so again, that was really, that was 1970. That wasn't a digital twin, was a physical simulator, but there you see all the ingredients, this idea of having a model, of being able to have this interaction between the physical and the model, and this updating to really drive key decisions with the very best information you can have.
So I guess a lot has changed since then, but how is this tech moving? Because now I guess we have not just, you know, large simulators, as you say, that would live somewhere like NASA. So many of us are walking around wearing some of these.
Yeah, that's right. So much has changed. So if we think about all the ingredients, let's start with the data. So much has changed in our ability to sense. The sensors that are on board aircraft, the sensors that are on board spacecraft, the sensors, like you said, that we wear every day, the medical technology that lets doctors do imaging, the different kinds of ways data can be collected about what's going on inside our body, things that we could never actually physically see. So the data have changed tremendously, and there is just so much more data and different kinds of data. At the same time, the models have also changed. So our ability to create a mathematical model and then solve that mathematical model with powerful computers, those are the kinds of models that, for example, engineers use to design aircraft or use to make predictions about how an aircraft engine might respond under different conditions. So those models have also progressed tremendously. Then you throw in the computing power. So we have so much more computing power, both at the level of high-performance computers, so huge supercomputers, all the way down to the computers that we all carry around in our pockets, and the kind of computers that could be on board something like a spacecraft or an aircraft. And so when you put all those different ingredients together, you start to see that we can go well beyond, just a digital twin of a relatively simple system, but we could really start thinking about digital twins of very complex systems, maybe one day all the way to the level of a digital twin of a city that could help us make better decisions about our commutes or better decisions about building, about using natural resources. So it's really, really an exciting time to be thinking about that future.
Mm. Yeah, what are some of the current limitations?
So there are many. I think, and again, if we think through all those ingredients, when we talk about big data, I think often people start to believe that we have all the data in the world and that that's enough, and that somehow magically we're going to analyze all this data and we're going to be able to make predictions about the future. That's not true. That's a huge limitation. And we could talk about that whether we're discussing an engineering system, whether we're discussing medicine, or maybe when we're thinking about climate change and modeling planet Earth. Even though we have so much more data than we used to, the data we have are still very, very sparse. They're really tiny little glimpses as to what's going on in these very complex systems. And what's also really important to remember is that's data about the past. And the whole game with the digital twin is learn from the past, but predict the future, and predict a future where maybe we're in conditions that we haven't seen before. So that's a big limitation. I would say another limitation is you know, we can start to create these digital twins, but how do we build in trust? How do we understand if I'm going to make these predictions? Again, it's a combination of data and models. I'm going to make predictions about the future, and that's going to guide a decision maker. How much can you trust those predictions? How do you factor in all the different risks? How do you factor in the different stakeholders? Decisions are never clear cut. There are so many competing things, you know, especially, for example, when we start thinking about planet Earth and how we manage resources. And how do we protect privacy? How do we think about ethics? These are all, again, huge challenges, so that as we take the excitement of this technology and what it could do to change people's lives, at the same time, we have to be taking on all these really difficult questions about how that technology might be deployed.
So it's not just about the pure science of it when you're beginning to look at things like data sovereignty. It's the ethics of it as well.
Absolutely. And this is why, as now I'll speak as an educator, as we start to think about education and education, let me talk at the university level, we absolutely still need to be educating people as computer scientists and engineers and mathematicians and humanists. But really importantly, we need to be breaking down those barriers and reminding ourselves that it's not just enough, for example, to educate an engineer about the technology alone. As this technology starts to get deployed in a very complex world, we have to be thinking about the ethics, the data sovereignty, the privacy, you know, the unintended consequences. And that really means breaking down barriers and bringing together fields that haven't traditionally come together.
You're listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National with Susie Ferguson. Professor Karen Wilcox is my guest, Director of the Auden Institute for Computational Engineering and Sciences at the University of Texas. We're talking about digital twins. What are some of the uses that you're beginning to see coming through for digital twins with these, you know, scraps of data in the sort of big world scheme? Of things like aerospace, of aviation, some of these ways that we are making strides?
So I think it's probably fair to say that aerospace engineering may be out in front a little bit when it comes to digital twins. As I mentioned, this is the field where the idea has its roots. And so we've seen some really successful deployments of digital twins, for example, in health monitoring for aircraft engines. So if you can imagine, you know, an aircraft engine, it's there on the commercial aircraft that we fly on, and it's seeing all kinds of different conditions. And of course, the engine on aircraft one is seeing very different conditions to the aircraft on engine two. So if you could imagine, the digital twin could start to monitor all those engines on an individual personalized basis, then you as the operator, you as Air New Zealand, get to make data-informed decisions about when to do the maintenance on the different aircraft. And of course, that then translates into more economically viable operation, but also into better engine performance, which in turn means these things running more efficiently and reduced carbon impact. So I think this has been one of the real success stories is digital twins for health monitoring in both airframes and aircraft engines.
How is it that the actual digital twin does the prediction, though? What is the mechanism?
So this is the magic of mathematics. I'm so glad you asked that question, Susie, because so often we talk about the systems, like the aircraft, because people can visualize them. But what's going on under the hood? This is the magic of mathematics. And I should say mathematics and statistics. Because my sister is listening, or maybe she's not listening, but my sister is a PhD in statistics, who's a high school teacher, and she would say, Karen, not just mathematics, also statistics. So if you have a lot of data, and that aircraft engine example I gave you is one where there's a ton of data being generated, then there are incredible methods where you can take all that data and you can analyze it in a very scalable way and use powerful statistical models. You can use machine learning to make predictions about the future, about different conditions. If you don't have as much data, this is where mathematical models come into play. And the mathematical models, they take different forms, but often they're in the form of differential equations. So these are governing equations that describe how physical things evolve in space and time. And the example that people might be most familiar with, I'm going to take you back to high school, is Newton's law. F equals ma, right? Force equals mass times acceleration. Acceleration is a derivative. That's where the differential comes in differential equations. It's a governing law that says if you push an object with this force, then here's how you expect to see it respond. And so that's a really simple example. We as engineers and medical people, as scientists, have this language of mathematics, these differential equations that describe so many of the complex systems that we see around us in the world. And it's taking those mathematical models, using powerful computational science methods, turning them into problems that we can solve on computers. That's how those predictions are made.
Mm. Do they only know what we tell them, though? I suppose I'm thinking of the personalized one, where I think it was the Apple Watch initially didn't have a period tracker on it. So for women, it was not giving a kind of complete data set. How do we deal with something like that when, you know, you don't know what you don't know?
Yeah, this is a great question. And this is, this really comes back to that challenge I mentioned of trust, which is sometimes you know what you don't know, and there you need to still characterize how much confidence you might have in a prediction that you're making. And sometimes, as you said, you don't even know what's missing, what's not represented in the data, because the data didn't sample a full representation of the population, or what's missing in the model because the model itself is missing a key part of the physics. And so this really brings us back to the frontiers where, again, we need to think about methods. We as academics need to think about methods that will embed this notion of what we call uncertainty quantification. How do we really start to quantify all those things that we don't know and build that in so that when the digital twin is issuing a prediction, and let's think of a digital twin interacting with maybe a human doctor, it's not only saying, here's what I predict and here's what I recommend, but it's also saying, well, actually, maybe here's a range of predictions. Here's what I'm most confident in, but here's where I'm really, really uncertain. And that's the goal. We're still, I think, far from being able to really do that. But I think that's a really, really important piece of being able to get these digital twins into these most high consequence applications.
Because medical uses are significant and widespread. What sort of things are digital twins already being used for in medicine?
You asked me earlier about where some of the successes are. I would say medicine is maybe the area where we're literally right on the cliff of a digital twin revolution. There's so many aspects of medicine where people are really excited about the notion of a digital twin. And I think one of the reasons that the notion of a digital twin is so exciting for medicine is that, historically we think about how medicine is done. It's treating to, let's say, an average in a population, right? You often, I don't know if you've ever done this, you pick up your off the shelf medicine and you look at the dosage and then you think, oh, I wonder, my husband who weighs 1 point something times I do, he takes the same dosage as I do. Everything's all about, just sort of averages. And of course, we as human beings are so very, very, very different. And when it comes to something like cancer patient treatment, where you have something called the standard of care, where all cancer patients of a particular kind receive the same treatment, we know that's not optimal. We know that people are different. Their physiology is different. Their anatomy is different. We know they're going to respond to different treatments in different ways. And this is where the digital twin can come in and say, hey, I don't need a one-size-fits-all model. How about we bring in some of your personal data and personalize your digital twin so that it can work together with your doctor, your clinicians, to help make better decisions that are tailored for you. And that's such an incredibly exciting thing to think about, I would say, all across medicine and all across health.
Specifically, though, the glioma project that is ongoing at the moment, what sort of strides is it making?
Yeah, so here at UT Austin, so, you know, I already said I'm an aerospace engineer, and one of sort of the wonderful collisions that happened here at the institute that I direct in Austin is that my group had done some work on laying a foundation for digital twins that we had developed in the context of unmanned aerial vehicles. So in the context of drones, I have a small drone in my research group that we fly and we build a digital twin of it. So we got talking with the computational oncology group in the Odin Institute, and they said, you know, we're really interested in this work, and we think that this work might have an application for cancer patients. And so we started collaborating with them, and I don't know if I should say these things on air, but I think biology was by far my least favorite part of science, and I'm not sure I retained any of it. So you can consider me basically a biology complete ignoramus. Anyway, we started talking, and I was so struck by the parallels. You know, we were thinking about the structural health monitoring of the wing of the aircraft. They were interested in the health monitoring of a cancer patient and their tumor. And so, long story short, we started collaborating. And what we've been able to do is bring those methods that we developed for the aircraft, bring them over, put them in the cancer patient setting, and come up with a way of, again, collecting individual patient data, calibrating a digital twin so that now it's personalized to that cancer patient, and then using that personalized digital twin to plan out an optimal, in this case, it's a dosage, like when and how much do you deliver doses of radiotherapy for glioma patients. So we're in the very early stages of this collaboration. At the moment, everything we've done is computer simulations to sort of try to test out the idea. But I'm really excited for where this might go in collaboration with our group here, and also in collaboration with MD Anderson Cancer Center, who are one of the big cancer centers here in the US. Really, really exciting.
Personalized medicine, I guess, is one of the areas that would really touch potentially a lot of lives very quickly, hopefully for good. But how to ensure that it is used for good? Because I guess this is the kind of information that potentially could, yes, be part of a treatment program, but also could be used by insurance companies, medical insurance companies, to decide whether treatment is viable or not.
Yeah, I think this is a great, great question, Susie. I mean, this is a really, really tough issue. And it's an issue we're all living already. There's so much of our data that is not ours, that we don't own anymore, that somehow, you know, things have come in and all kinds of people are getting their hands on our data, and sometimes they're using it for good. Sometimes it really helps me when I open up my computer and I see an ad for something and I think, oh gosh, I really do need that. But sometimes it's maybe not being used for good. And, you know, again, we come back to these questions of data privacy ethics, who should own the digital twin. How do you manage a digital twin where the data may be collected across your lifetime by many, many different providers? How do you use it for good? I think these are great questions. And really, I would say that this is at the forefront of the discussions in the medical community. So it certainly is something that people are taking on very seriously. There's just no, I would say, not great answers yet.
We've had a few questions come in for you, Karen, while we've been on air this morning. Carl says, can I ask how digital twins interact with artificial intelligence?
Yes, it's a great question. So I would sort of turn it around a little bit, and I would say that methods of AI can and do play a big role in a digital twin. So many of the methods that underlie what you might think of as artificial intelligence, so particularly some of the neural network representations, they form some of those mathematical models that I was talking about, and they, in many cases, will play a key role in being inside the digital twin. If we turn the question around the other way, and the question is, you know, would a digital twin one day be part of something we might think of as like an AI assistant, then I think, you know, again, you could think there's a lot of synergy there. So I think there's a lot of potential points of connections.
Another person has said, this is from Jen actually, saying the clock, the doomsday clock that shows how close the world is to midnight, is that essentially a digital twin?
I actually don't even know what the doomsday clock is.
Oh, it comes out every year and it describes how close to midnight we are, midnight being Armageddon. And it keeps moving closer, which I guess is a little bit unnerving, or rather unnerving for a lot of people. But I guess it's the idea that it is giving a prediction of how close we are to some sort of major catastrophic event.
I got you. I guess so. I'll first of all say that across the community, across the world, there are many different definitions of digital twins, and so some people might say yes, it's a digital twin. Some people might say no. My answer would be no, and one of the things that has been keeping me busy in the last year and a half is I've been chairing a major national study for the National Academies here in the United States, where we've looked at digital twins across engineering, medicine, and climate sustainability sciences. And one of the things that that study took on was to try to provide a definition of a digital twin. Really key in our definition is this idea of the bidirectional interaction between the virtual and the physical. So we talk about collecting data from the physical world and feeding it into the virtual, into the digital twin. But the other part of that interaction is the digital twin then having an impact back in the physical world. So I guess I would say, you know, challenge with the doomsday clock example, is the doomsday clock in turn affecting some change on the physical world? And maybe we could lightheartedly say the answer is no, but it should be.
Yeah, I think it's currently at 90 seconds to midnight, that one. So it's certainly something that's been ticking closer over the last decade or so. Another person asks, and this is an interesting question, how much energy will be required to run all these models? How much is that taken into account?
This is a fantastic question. And by the way, this is a question that we should be asking ourselves, not just for digital twins, but you know, anytime you use ChatGPT, you should be cognizant of the energy that's been used to train those large language models. This is a really important topic, and it's one that I'm really starting to see bubble up in the computational science and computer science communities, where the energy costs of computing are starting to be a factor that we have to really, really weigh in. And if we come back to this notion of a digital twin, you can imagine, put yourselves in the shoes of, I don't know, maybe you want to be an airline that operates aircraft, or maybe you want to be Amazon one day operating all these thousands of drones that are going to deliver packages. You have to make decisions when you're acquiring your assets, your physical assets. You have to make decisions about, do you want high-end drones? Do you want low-end ones? How much money do you want to spend on them? How many sensors do you want to put on board? The same is true in the digital world. You need to make decisions and trade-offs about your digital assets. And parts of those trade-offs are going to be the computing power that they consume and those energy costs. So again, I'm really glad this question was asked. I think this is a really important question, again, not just for digital twins, but for everything we do with computing. How do we start to factor in the energy costs and make sure that we have responsible use of all this computing power that is starting to become available?
Yeah, certainly one for people to ponder and to think about, for sure. I'm interested in you, I suppose, as well. Your life and career. You grew up in Auckland, I think.
I did,
You were
yeah.
the first in your family to go to university, and as you said, you've got a sister who's got a PhD in statistics. So, pretty extraordinary family that you've come from.
It's been a wonderful journey. Yes, I look back. So I grew up in Massey in West Auckland, and feel incredibly fortunate to have had just amazing teachers and mentors along the way. And if I think back to my primary school days, Lincoln Heights Primary School, I think about some of those incredibly influential teachers that I had in those very early days. They sort of put me on this path. Of course, I never dreamed I would end up with a PhD, let alone a professor. But it's been quite amazing. I still keep really close connections with New Zealand. Most of my family is still there. I actually have a house there in Auckland, try to come back frequently. I have two children, both of them. I managed to time it so that they were both born in Auckland. So still lots of connections.
You nearly became an astronaut.
So that was the childhood dream. When I was growing up, I had no idea what I wanted to do, except that I wanted to be an astronaut. And I guess when I was five, it was sort of a crazy dream. When I was 10, it was still a crazy dream. As I got a little bit older, maybe it's still crazy, but a little bit more attainable. So I ended up, I did my undergraduate in engineering science at University of Auckland. And then I went and I did my master's and PhDs at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Aerospace Engineering. And it was really, the fascination with all things air and space, but also the stream of being an astronaut that led me into aerospace engineering. And then I was lucky enough, once I became a US citizen, I was lucky enough to be able to apply twice and make it to the final round twice. So I got pretty close, but did not quite make it. But still, it was still just an incredibly inspiring dream to have. And like I said, it put me on this amazing path.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, too, for being in touch with us on Saturday morning here at RNZ National. That is Professor Karen Wilcox, Director of the Auden Institute for Computational Engineering and Sciences at the University of Texas, originally from Auckland.